This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, as always, Jesse Collings. I have no guests today, but I am not doing this show alone because I have all of these wonderful questions that my readers sent in that I am going to go through in today's mailbag episode of the podcast. So I've got a bunch of good questions. I'm always really impressed with the thoughtfulness that people put into all of these questions. They really help energize my thoughts and make me think about a lot of different things in wrestling. And I have a lot of I'm really appreciative of the amount of respect people put into the amount of time that they take to come up with these questions. I don't know about you guys. As a, I guess I'm a creative type. I don't really like using that phrase. It just sounds kind of weird. But as someone that produces content and likes to write articles and record podcasts, I really operate the best when just something hits me and I'm immediately motivated to do something, whether that's recording some audio or writing an article. And like, people might have noticed that this week or maybe last week, depending on when people listen to this, I published two articles on voiceofwrestling.com in back-to-back days. I had one article that was about like the AEW discourse, and it was kind of like a tongue-in-cheek article about the 9 different types of fans that ruin the AEW discourse and just why talking about AEW is so annoying, which I've elaborated on this podcast before. And then the next day I wrote a long article about Nigel McGuinness and his upcoming match against Bryan Danielson and how excited I am for that match, and also kind of the tragedy of Nigel. We basically lost 13 years of Nigel's career because there was no place in wrestling that really valued him at a level that he thought would be commiserate with him becoming making it as a professional. So he retired up until extremely recently. So I posted those two articles like back-to-back days, which I usually post like, I don't know, like one article a month to voiceofwrestling.com. And the reason I did that was just because that creativity hits me and my mind is going in the right direction and I'm able to produce content like pretty efficiently. And that's what I like about getting all these questions and just being able to talk to all the different listeners that take their time to come up with these questions, because it really does help get those creative gears turning in my head. And some of my like best content has probably come from being generated from reader questions and reader interactions. So I really appreciate that. Anyway, the first question so far to ask is from Chris Gannon, and Chris asks, why do dogs have cold noses? So, of course, after that long intro where I talked about how great all the questions are and how it helps my mind get centered for wrestling, Chris goes ahead and asks the question, why do dogs have cold noses? And according to my very, very brief research, but it wasn't amateur research because I am a journalist, so I am a professional at doing this. It seems to be the general belief among veterinarians is that dogs have cold noses because they're licking them constantly, which I've never really thought about before. And the reason like a dog's nose is going to be wetter in a lower temperature than the surrounding area is because dogs lick their noses all the time, which, again, I haven't really thought about before, but I have a dog and my dog licks her nose all the time. I see her. I always kind of think of it as like licking her lips, but she's really licking her nose. And okay, so that tells us, you know, why dogs have cold noses, but gosh, why are dogs licking their nose all the time? What the hell is going on? I guess science tells us that a wet surface can hold scent particles better than a dry surface, which I can't prove or I've never really heard of that before, but to use dogs as another example, everyone knows when your dog gets wet, your dog starts smelling stronger, usually unpleasantly, and you get the wet dog smell. And that doesn't really make any sense realistically. Like if your dog just got wet with water, it shouldn't really smell any different. Water doesn't really smell, unless the water smells weird, which it shouldn't, should have a neutral smell because it's water. Your dog's scent shouldn't change. Your dog's scent didn't change. It just got wetter. And when something's wet, it smells stronger. So that's why dogs keep licking their nose all the time, because they're making their nose wet to give it a stronger sense of scent, a smell and scent. And obviously we all know dogs rely on their sense of smell. My older dog, she's gone pretty deaf. I don't know if she's blind, but she's definitely like probably like 50 to 75% deaf. And so her sense of smell is super important to her. So that's why dogs have cold noses. I can't believe I just elaborated that. But thank you, Chris, for the question. Moving on, it's a question from Prince. Prince asks, what is your favorite shade of foliage and what trees produce the best foliage? A lot of these questions are about New England lifestyle, because I have said before that this is primarily a New England lifestyle podcast that talks about wrestling sometimes. But this, of course, coming from Prince. What is your favorite shade of foliage? Well, I think you have to say, just, you know, quick instant reaction is red. Red is the most dynamic color of a fall. I don't know what the percentage is, but I imagine probably like something like 10 to 15% of all trees that turn a color in the fall time turn red, which makes it a little bit rarer. But if you really think about it, like, the red only stands out because it's so rare. If red was everywhere, if like 75% of trees turned red, it wouldn't be special at all. We'd be talking about yellow or orange as the premier fall color, which is why I'm actually not going to say red. I'm going to say like that golden yellow that helps, you know, fill up, you know, the view. If you're looking at a bunch of trees in the wilderness somewhere at the fall time, seeing all that row and row of gold, and then you see a little bit of colors of red here and there, maybe a little orange, maybe a little bit of a paler yellow here and there, but that nice crisp golden orange, it's like kind of like the color of a basketball almost. That's probably my favorite shade of foliage if we're just taking it in totality, because that was what really helps the red stand out, is that sea of beautiful orange. What trees produce the best foliage? There's probably a scientific answer to this, but I'm just going to say maple trees, because maple trees have those nice, wide, big leaves. There's a maple tree near my house that is really old and very large, and it has these enormous, enormous, like, beautiful maple leaves. Like, the leaves are like probably like the span of like a standard paper plate is how I would describe it. That's got to be the best tree with the best foliage. You know, oak trees, those leaves are pretty big too. But the maple, you can't beat the maple tree in the fall. I mean, I honestly don't know what else would be an answer for that. I'm sure maybe like there's certain types of trees that have just amazingly different colored foliage. But just as an amateur, botanist, I would go with maple trees as being the best of the foliage. Okay, Prince actually has a wrestling question too. His question is, during the COVID pandemic, AEW filmed two episodes of television on back-to-back days, one live and one taped. When the taped episode aired, there was no noticeable drop or increase in TV ratings that could be attributed to the episode not being live. If there is no ratings drop and the show is presented as, quote, live, why doesn't AEW or WWE block tape their TV products to cut costs? Is it just a matter of having the live prestige, or is the answer simply contractual reasons? It's a great question. I think we grew up like, you know, 10 years ago when I would read The Observer and listen to Dave. You know, a frequent thing as he would talk about was that, you know, taped episodes never do as good as live episodes. And I haven't researched that and gone back and kind of researched that, but I definitely agree with Prince that we don't really see a big difference between taped and live. I think we notice this especially like during when WWE and recently AEW have TV tapings that are outside of the Eastern time zone, like when they're in England or Europe, and you know the episode will be taped during the day because it's nighttime there, and then when it airs in primetime East Coast time here in the US, you probably could have already figured out the results because they were already online from the people that were at the taping live. And we don't really see any difference in television ratings because of that. So it seems like that trend of, you know, something needing to be live is going to generate better ratings hasn't been talked about in a while. And it seems like it's pretty much dead. So I think Prince is right in that I think it might be a prestige issue where networks and companies, they just like taping live. They like saying we are live. They like being able to simulcast, you know, the live showing of something. That's what pro sports do. That's what real sports do. They don't air on tape delay. There's probably certain like prestige and allure of the live product that extends beyond just, you know, people be more interested in a live product, which seems to be a pretty negligible difference at this point in time. In terms of, I also think that if you were to block tape back to back, you know, as Prince talks about, these were, you know, during the pandemic, AEW did that. Well, that was okay because there wasn't really any fans in the building, or there was so limited number of fans, because I know at Daily's Place, they were, you know, having fans here and there later in the time they were taping there. But you weren't going because, you know, if there are empty seats everywhere, crowd wasn't making a lot of noise. That wasn't really that big of an issue because it was the COVID-19 pandemic. We were kind of accepting of whatever presentation of live sports we were going to get was what we were going to get. We knew we weren't going to have a stadium full of people, so it didn't really matter. I do think when you start, if you want to tape like two episodes of Dynamite back to back, like you're going to start, we're talking about a 4+ hour taping. And on that second half of taping, people are going to leave. We've seen this with Rampage. We've seen this when they tape Collision after a Dynamite, that a lot of people just aren't going to stick around for 4 hours. So then you're starting to hurt your live atmosphere by, you know, you might have a hot crowd for the Dynamite, but then when the Rampage or when the Collision airs, all of a sudden, you know, half the building is empty. And trust me, AEW at this point, they can't lose half the fans that are actually there. The buildings are already kind of sparse enough due to some of their live attendance issues that you can't really afford to run off some of those fans with a long running, super long marathon TV taping. So I think that's probably part of it too. I think it is interesting, like WWE, could they experiment with this more? Because WWE really, as a publicly traded company, they really are about improving the bottom dollar. And if they could cut costs on tapings, they probably would. But maybe for the same reasons about the prestige and the network considerations that maybe contractually they have to be live X number of episodes per year. So that's probably another reason as well. Chris Nothing asks, North Shore Beef Three-Way or South Shore Bar Pizza? Now, this is a very Massachusetts-specific question. Chris is asking if I would rather eat South Shore Bar Pizza or North Shore Roast Beef. So for people that don't know this, a North Shore Beef Three-Way is like this thin roast beef sandwich that has, I think, usually like provolone or American cheese on the bottom and then is layered in mayonnaise. I don't know if they have it like in other parts of the country. I'm told that like in Massachusetts has like every town has its own like roast beef shop. It's usually called like blank, whatever the town's name is, House of Roast Beef, like Danvers House of Roast Beef or Reading House of Roast Beef or Salem House of Roast Beef. And I'm told that this is not something that exists in other parts of the country. Like it's equivalent to your local pizza place or your local Chinese food place. Every town's got its pizza place. Every town's got its Chinese food place. Every town's got its roast beef place. Where I live, it's a place called Mimi's. I'm told that this is something that doesn't exist in other parts of the country, and people can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just told this is a very specific Massachusetts thing. And the North Shore, which Chris is referring to, is the suburban area north of Boston, is famous for its roast beef in particular. There's a lot of Greek immigrants in that area. They all run the roast beef shops. I don't like roast beef. I don't like mayonnaise. So I'm a terrible person to answer this question. So I'm just going to say South Shore Bar Pizza, which is a specific type of pizza that they sell on the South Shore, which remember what I said about the North Shore, the South Shore is just a suburban area south of Boston. So I'm going to go with bar pizza just simply because I don't like roast beef. I have to say, if you do like roast beef, I'd probably go with the North Shore Beef Three-Way because that's just kind of a unique sandwich that you can only get around here. South Shore Bar Pizza, it's kind of just pizza. It's a little bit different than regular pizza, but it's not like wildly different than like, you know, your little pizza. It's kind of like super crispy, Not like super thin like Brooklyn pizza, but it's like kind of like pan crispy pizza. Hopefully there's some more. Actually, I was going to say hopefully there's some more wrestling questions, but man, there are a lot of non-wrestling questions in here, which is fine because clearly this is what the readers want to listen to. Chris Bork asks, why are AEW simultaneously succeeding in pay-per-view buys while struggling with ticket sales? Which do you see changing first, and what lessons can they take from pay-per-view sales to improve ticket sales? There's a lot to unpack here. I would say that the biggest difference, there's two major reasons. The first is simply like a live ticket show. If you're going to a live event, that is like the biggest commitment you can make to the AEW product, right? You are going to purchase some tickets. They might cost more than $100. You can get them for cheaper, but you might be spending, you know, if you're buying a couple, you're bringing your kids or your girlfriend or whatever, you're going to be spending, you know, more than $100. You're going to be making a night of it. You might have to drive a decent distance to get there. It's a pretty big commitment. You got to be pretty motivated to buy a live ticket. A pay-per-view, yeah, it's expensive. It's $50, but you can buy that, you know, you just have to watch it at your house. It's basically if just, are you around on this night? You're looking for something to do, buy one of the pay-per-views. So that's why I always think like a live ticket is kind of like a, not only is it kind of a consistent trend throughout history to indicate success, but it also shows how committed fans are to the product, where that, because that is the biggest real commitment from someone's time and really financially that they can make to the product is to buy a live ticket to attend a show. The second distinctive difference between the two, I think, is, and this is especially true since Collision has been added to the AEW lineup, is that between Dynamite and Collision, you're never really 100% sure until like sometimes the day of the show who is going to appear on that show. So fans don't really know that much about who they're going to see if they buy a ticket to a live event. They don't know if, you know, if you know, tickets just went on sale for a show that I'm going to go to, I think in November. It's in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's a Dynamite taping. Like, I don't really know who's going to be on that show. Like, is Bryan Danielson going to be on that show? Is Jon Moxley going to be on that show? Is MJF going to be on that show? I don't know who is going to be on that show from like a top star perspective. And I won't probably really know that until like maybe the day of, maybe like the day, the week before on Dynamite, they'll have like a match or two. Next week on Dynamite, it will be this wrestler versus this wrestler. And I'll be like, oh, okay. You know, Jon Moxley's got a match against, I don't know, Wheeler Yuta at this show. That means, you know, Dynamite is going to have at least one match with a big star on it. But really until the day of, like when, it's until the day of the show that you find out who's going to be on the shows. And I think that's hurt their live attendance, just simply because you don't know who is going to be on their shows. With WWE, their attendance is really strong, and that's for a number of reasons. But I do think that one of the reasons is with the brand split, you know who is going to be on a show. If you buy tickets to Raw, you know that there's an extremely good chance, if not a guarantee, that CM Punk is going to be on that show, that Drew McIntyre is going to be on that show, that Rhea Ripley is going to be on that show. And conversely, if you buy tickets to a SmackDown, you know that most likely Cody Rhodes is going to be on that show. You know, Kevin Owens might be on that show. So you know you're going to get stars. No, we don't know if Roman Reigns is going to be on that show, but you know what you're going to get when you buy a WWE ticket to an event. With AEW, you really don't. And I think that's something that they've got to work on. I'm not saying they have to do a brand split. I'm not saying that they, but they at least have to do a better job, I think, announcing stuff at least a week in advance so fans know what kind of tickets they're getting, who they, what they're buying tickets for. And the opposite is for pay-per-views, right? Pay-per-views, you know exactly who's going to be on the card. You know the show's probably going to be good because AEW track record is so good on pay-per-views. So there's no mystery element to that. And I think that's a big difference. And one of the things that I think AEW needs to improve upon, it's never going to be like, you know, pay-per-views, you build up all these angles and then have a very clear lineup. Usually, you know, the main event of pay-per-views is usually decided 3 or 4 weeks out in advance, if not further. And then the other major show matches, even if they're not necessarily announcing the matches until like the week before, you kind of know the direction of where they're going. And you could basically expect that pretty much every big name is going to be on every pay-per-view because that's the most important show. So the pay-per-views are just a far better guarantee of star power and quality than buying a live event ticket. And that's the big difference between the two. And it's going to be hard to, it's pretty much impossible to get live event quality up to pay-per-view level, because the whole point of pay-per-view is that's supposed to be an amazing show with all of the stars having big matches. But I do think that they've got to do just a better job letting the audience know who is going to be on the show that's coming to their town. And especially with the introduction of Collision, because before Collision, yeah, there was, you know, weeks where guys weren't on TV, but now it's like almost like, you know, okay, your top stars are either going to be on an episode of Collision or an episode of Dynamite. You know, guys pull double duty sometimes, but realistically you're looking at one per week, and there's really no rhyme or reason why what they'll be on one show and the other, like the way there is with WWE, which has the formal brand split. So that's, I think, a really big distinct difference and something that needs to be talked about when we talk about AEW's attendance woes, is because you really, when you want to go to an AEW show, you don't really know what you're going to get. You know, the show's probably going to be good. I feel like confident in saying that, but that's not going to get people in the door. They want to know who's going to be on it. What big wrestlers are they going to see? What stars do you have? Cause you're spending all this energy in building stars, promoting stars. You want Swerve Strickland to be a star. You want Mercedes Moné to come across like a big star. You bring it, sign Okada to be a big star. But fans, when AEW is coming to your city, unless it's a pay-per-view, you don't really know, maybe until the day of that show, if you're going to get those big stars on your show. And that's a major problem and something that's got to be addressed going forward. The next question is, Kaze Ni Nair asks, what are your thoughts on what can leave an impression product-wise in today's American wrestling? The more I think about it, the more it is homogenized. Personally, at this point, I have no interest in giving a, quote, normal product a shot. But if something gimmicky, say like Chikara, popped up today, I would probably be over it just due to the stark difference to today's work-ready products. Do you see this changing in the near future? Do you think something like a Lucha Underground or a Chikara could have success in the current environment? I mean, there's actually another question that's kind of related to this that later in this mailbag that I'll get to, but it's a good question in the sense of, I think there are distinct differences between like AEW's product and WWE's product. But Kaze Ni Nair makes a pretty good point in the sense that it does really feel very similar in the sense of how the product is shot, how it's presented, what the wrestler's motivations are, and things like that. And is there a way to do pro wrestling kind of on a major scale, or at least a semi-major scale, that would be radically different than that? And the Lucha Underground is probably a good example in terms of they went with something totally different and I would say unique in terms of an aesthetic, in terms of what they were going to kind of present. They were going to have a studio wrestling show that was kind of glammed up with, you know, dramatic theming like you would see on a game show or something like that. Have this really, you know, Mexican-American inspired product, obviously inspired by Lucha Libre, but also have these elements of like, you know, Latin soap operas and things like that. So it's a very unique product. I could with anything, it kind of has to be the right time and place. You'd have to have the right wrestling people in charge. You would have to have the right financial sponsorship. You would have to have the right television partner to really stand out. I would say like something that's totally different in Women's of Wrestling, which is using like this glow like approach to pro wrestling, but nobody talks about that promotion. I guarantee most people who are big wrestling fans couldn't name like three wrestlers who wrestle for that promotion. So I think it just has to be, there is a way to do things differently. I'm not going to sit here and deny that there isn't, because I think there always is in an artistic endeavor, especially something like pro wrestling, which as Kaze Ni Nair says, is pretty homogenized. It's just really difficult to see because we haven't really seen something like that really take off and be super successful. I think like there was definitely a time period where like in Japan, your shoot style promotions, which are very different, you know, presentation wise and how sports based they are. They had a time and place. I don't think that they ended up proving to be successful in the long run. I definitely think that MMA has taken a lot of steam out of that idea of pro wrestling. And honestly, I just don't think enough, this isn't a topic that isn't talked about enough, but like mixed martial arts and UFC, like had a, just a gigantic impact on the professional wrestling industry. It took a lot of fans that maybe would have been pro wrestling fans in another lifetime, in another time period, and made them fans of this other thing. And it also kind of naturally pitted them against pro wrestling because they were watching the real product while instead of watching the fake product. You know, when I was in high school, MMA was pretty big. People were talking about Georgia St. Pierre and, you know, Chuck Liddell and those kind of guys. Tito Ortiz, and people were not talking about John Cena or, you know, Edge or Randy Orton that much. And I just think that it really created kind of like this mentality that, and I don't know if this is really like a philosophy that makes a ton of sense, but it's definitely the one that's been adopted, which is that we can't be super sports based because we can't compete with the real sports. So we have to be a little bit cartoony. We have to be a little bit sports entertainment-y to really capture a wide audience. And that seems to be the prevailing thought. So could you do something that was a more sports based presentation and have that appeal? I think that would matter less than the business aspects that I talked about before. Like, I just think a lot of it would be, you have to have the right person in charge that understands the creative vision that they want to have, which I think is hard to find. You have to have someone with the resources to want to get invested in pro wrestling that also understands the pro wrestling business, which is very difficult. We've seen plenty of startups in pro wrestling kind of flop because the people didn't really know what they were doing. You got to have TV partners, which is super, super difficult. I mean, AEW is nothing without their television partners. And the fact that Tony Khan had, you know, kind of prior relationships with Warner Brothers Discovery and had some connections with his, due to his professional sports background, really made it possible for him to get a major television deal with Warner Brothers Discovery and get that kind of distribution. Without that, AEW is nothing. So I think it's really hard for me to think of a product making a dent in today's society without those factors. And I almost think if you do have those factors, then you could talk about experimenting with a different version of the product. But I think that the actual presentation and version of a product matters so little compared to the business aspects of getting something off of the ground that makes it really difficult to envision that happening. But I do wonder if like a more sports-based presentation could really work on a major scale the way that AEW has worked. Kaze Ninaer asks, he says, what's your favorite New England Revolution player? I imagine he's asking, who is your favorite New England Revolution player? I don't know if this is like a like all-time question or current question. I think that, you know, most New England Revolution fans are obligated to say that Clint Dempsey is their favorite Revolution player of all time. Not really because of what he did with the club. He was a good player with the club, but to go from playing for the New England Revolution to, you know, representing the U.S. national team, I think being the joint all-time leading scorer for the U.S. men's national team, scoring big goals in World Cup, going to Europe and playing at a high level. I mean, he scored the winner when he was playing for Fulham. He famously scored the winner in a game against Juventus, which sent Fulham to the finals of the Europa League Cup. That's, you know, probably the biggest club goal an American has ever scored. I think Tyler Adams scored a goal in the Champions League knockout stage for Red Bull Leipzig, but that goal by Clint Dempsey is like a super dramatic goal. That's probably like, I don't know, it's probably the biggest goal in Fulham club history. I don't know, maybe there's a bigger one somewhere, but it's hard to think of one off the top of my head. So that's like really like you're kind of obligated to say that Clint Dempsey is the best, your favorite New England Revolution player of all time. Another guy that I would say is a guy named Charlie Joseph. People probably are less familiar with him. I assume most people know who Clint Dempsey is. that are soccer fans. But Charlie Joseph was a player right around the same time as Clint Dempsey. And he was, I believe he played for Granada. He didn't play for the United States. But he was like kind of a defensive midfielder kind of type. Really athletic, good ball winner. Played a ton of years for the club. And he was just kind of like, you know, he wasn't a flashy player, but he was the kind of classic workmanlike player that everyone can come to appreciate if you watch the game closely. When I was a kid, when I was like 13, he came to one of our soccer practices and ran us through drills. He was a super nice guy. Really, really fun player to root for. I think he does still do some like developmental work with the Revolution Academy team and things like that. But I'm a big fan of Charlie Joseph. I'm actually looking up this now. He was the head coach of the Granada international team at one point too. And now he's a Revolution assistant coach with the Academy. So that's pretty cool. So he's probably my favorite player of all time, along with Clint Dempsey, who I'm obligated to say. My favorite player now is it's probably Carlos Gil, just because, I mean, he's obviously their best player. He's a former MLS MVP. He is the kind of player, him and Gustavo Bow really were the two players who helped the Revolution kind of get back on track after they had gone from being one of the most consistently competitive teams in MLS to really falling behind the pack, especially in some of the newer clubs that were seeing a lot more investments. And after some down years, the Kraft family basically decided they need to shake up the team and actually spend some money on international players. And Carlos Gil, perfect fit, just like Gustavo Bow. They, you know, picked him up from Deportivo La Corona, I think. And he's went on to be, he's basically been one of the best players in MLS since he came over. Super creative midfielder. My one problem with Carlos Gil is that he has used his status as a key player on the Revolution to get his not particularly good brother, Nacho Gil, onto the Revolution and like a total Nepo hire that I'm not a huge fan of. But other than that, like Carl Skill's pretty good. Noel Buck, who's a young midfielder from the Revolution, who's kind of made some noises, like a box-to-box kind of midfield prospect. He had a really good year last year. He hasn't been as good this year. But he's from Arlington, Massachusetts, which is nearby where I'm from. I actually interviewed him when he was only like 14, when I was covering Arlington, Mass several years ago. So I'll always be looking out for him. But those are my favorite Revolution players. I'm sure everyone cares about what those answers were and this was dying to hear that. But thank you for the question, Kaze Ninier. There's another soccer question coming later. I hope everyone's prepared for that. Anyway, Avengers 23 asks, the WWE Network seems to show that there isn't a wide demand for tape libraries of defunct companies. Nonetheless, there are multiple libraries still out there from American Indies heyday. Chikara, Shimmer, PWG, FIP, CZW, that feature current stars in AEW and WWE. Should Tony Khan pursue buying these libraries to package them with ROH and AEW content for whatever streamer they end up signing with, or is the ROI too low for that? The return on investment. I would say that the ROI is probably too low on that. I would say that like the hardcore AEW fans, which are the, you know, a lot of the people who would be interested in getting a streaming, you know, platform that has AEW content on it, those fans would be really interested in like PWG video library, Chikara, Shimmer, the kind of, you know, stuff you mentioned in your question, you know, those fans would be probably more interested in it than your average WWE fan. Whether or not those fans who are probably going to get the streaming service anyway are enough to make it seem like a feasible financial investment remains to be seen. I don't know if, you know, how valuable the people who own these libraries currently view them as, if they're, you know, if they want six figures for them, seven figures for them. It probably depend on the company, and who owns them. I also don't know who owns each and every one of these. Are they, sometimes you have like split, ownership rights where someone owns X% and another party owns a different percent. And if you want to purchase it, you got to satisfy both parties instead of just one. So I'm sure it can be complicated. If I don't think it's really worth it from like a business perspective, I don't think it's really going to move the needle. Is Tony Khan a big enough wrestling nerd where he's like, I want to hold on to all this, especially because I don't want WWE to have it? Yes, he is. So if Tony Khan wants to do that and he wants to purchase those tape libraries, I'm sure he could make an offer big enough to the respective people who own those properties that would leave them satisfied. So if Tony Khan wants to do it, sure. It really depends on what they're going for. I mean, the fact of the matter is a streaming deal with AEW, the value in that, just like the value in the WWE network, is not going to be in a tape library. It's going to be in the production of live events. So pay-per-views, PLEs, whatever you want to call them. That's really what is going to drive any streaming deal. I don't think the tape library, even the tape library of like AEW itself, is really going to move the needle. I do wonder like about some of these tapes and things. Like, I was thinking about this with the original All In show, which of course, one of the most historically important wrestling shows the last 20, 25 years. And I was thinking like, you know, Joey Ryan and, you know, Marty Scurll, two like totally canceled people, are like really pivotal figures on that show. And I'm just kind of curious to know, like, eventually if they do make that show available for purchase and if they do advertise it as like a something you can get if you subscribe to whatever streaming service the AEW video library is on, like, are they going to advertise those guys? Is it going to be like Chris Benoit where you can't search their name? Like, especially say you get like a PWG video library, right? And you get all these canceled people that worked all these PWG matches. Is it going to be like a Benoit situation where, you know, they're going to be there, but you can't search their name and they're kind of like scrubbed out of anything of history? I was thinking about that because if you are talking about a video library, especially for some of these indie companies, there's going to be some people that are making appearances that you maybe wouldn't want to have showcased on your network. So I'm curious to know how they would do that. But that's all, you know, down the road, if any of that stuff ends up happening. Another question from Prince is, what prospects from the indies were you following that you thought would have broken out and got signed somewhere, but for whatever reasons didn't? I thought about this for a little bit. There were definitely some guys in Chikara that I thought were going to be really big stars or had really big potential, and they never worked out. I'll say one guy who I was really impressed when he started kind of emerging and then sadly never did anything else really in wrestling, I think largely due to his own issues and his own volition, was Kevin Condren. He was in Chikara. Most people probably know him as Jervis Cottonbelly, you know, one of the meme wrestlers from 10 years ago. And he did an angle where he basically went under the name Kevin Condren, which I don't know if that is his real name or not, in Chikara, where he was basically turning heel on the promotion. He wanted to save Chikara from all this evil stuff that was going on in the company. And it was Chikara, so of course it was kind of wacky. But I remember seeing him as like, this guy's cutting really good, dramatic, serious promos in a way, and especially in a company like Chikara, you don't really see that. And I'm like, this guy has a lot of potential. And I don't want to get too far into the details because I don't have them all, but I believe there are certain personality reasons why his career never took off. I know that he insisted on working as Jervis Cottonbelly instead of a more serious character, which probably would have had more legs. But he was someone that I was really high on when I first saw him, and it just never came together at all. Some other guys that I can think of off the top of my head, Peter Casa, who people might remember from working Evolve shows, and he also did some stuff in Dragon Gate. Just like super, super athletic guy, gymnast background, you know, had the, you know, kind of like, I would say kind of like Pac in that he was like really strong for his size, but could do all these flips. Believe he got injured on a show. I'm sure people listening will know exactly what happened to him. But I believe he got injured. It might've been an Evolve show, but I'm not 100% sure. But he basically got injured and just said, okay, wrestling isn't for me. And I believe he is a firefighter now. But he was someone just from a physical standpoint, I thought could have been a really special in-ring performer. Never panned out. there's some other guys, I think like Shinran, who, let me see if he's actually still wrestling. But Shinran, who worked, I believe he works at MLW, but I first saw him in Chikara. Really athletic, again, like a flippity-do guy. Really probably would have fit in well with a lot of the, you know, high flyers of his era. Let's see, I think he's still active. Yes, he's working under the name Ariel Van Gogh. Okay, so he's doing, I can just tell he's kind of a meme wrestler now. Let's see. Okay, so he's done some GCW matches this year. He's also bounced around, just basically still staying in the US Indies. I remember he was in MLW for a little bit, a couple of years ago. But a guy that I first saw in Chikara and like wrestling is, really athletic guy, could do a lot of stuff in the ring. Thought he would probably have more memorable matches, but he's more in like that. I guess he's more in like that Jack Evans and Flip Kendrick kind of role where he's really athletic. He can rotate a lot. He can do this cool stuff, but never really put it together as a wrestler. So those are just some people. I don't know exactly. There's other people like Saturine that I know. I had some stock in when they were in Chikara, but things didn't work out for them. For various reasons. But yeah, those would be some of the ones. Adam Berger, frequent guest on the show, asks, related to that question from Prince, conversely, who do you think sucked that went on to become highly successful? I'm trying to think, like, in terms of becoming highly successful, and who sucked? I guess on the indies, like I never really developed super strong feelings on people sucking, just because if they like the indies were so like opportunistic where like I would watch what I wanted to watch. And if somebody sucked, I wouldn't watch their matches. So I didn't really know them all that much. As far as wrestlers that I never really liked that went on to become highly successful, like, well, right now, like Dominic is someone who I think totally sucks, but it's hard to deny that they're not very successful as a wrestler. So they would be one for sure. But that's kind of like, you know, WWE decided to push this person who sucked, not someone who just kind of developed and became successful. I don't know if Matt Riddle would be considered highly successful, but I was never a huge fan of Matt Riddle, even when he was on the indies. I don't really like guys that do MMA gimmicks and stuff like that. It just, it's never really appealed to me. There's something aesthetically about, you know, coming up in the fight shorts and bare feet that I'm like, you know, I don't know, what is this? I know it's what real fighters wear, but I just never, he never really stood out to me as an interesting talent all that much. But I'm trying, I can't really think of someone who I just like thought was terrible and like just kept getting pushes and things like that. And they ended up making it as a pro wrestler. Really off the top of my head. I mean, there are some women that like Alexa Bliss, who I never thought were any good at all, and they became successful, but I don't like, it's not like they became good. Just, you know, WWE decided to push somebody and people liked her for different reasons, but it's never like I thought she was any, she, like I was wrong that she wasn't any good. She's still never any good. That's a tough one. I'm trying to rack my brain here and really think about somebody who I got like a really bad first impression of and then like maybe changed my opinion on them a little bit. No, it's honestly really hard. I don't want to say like I have perfectly own instincts, but I guess I think it's more the opposite. I think I just like really only get behind somebody if there's buzz. But I can't think of anything too big off the top of my head, but maybe I'll come back to that. I'll answer that maybe in the Discord if I can think of anyone, or I'm really interested in hearing what other people actually have to think, because it's hard for me to kind of do that from a thought exercise, but I'd be really interested in hearing what other people think about wrestlers who suck that went on to become highly successful, maybe got bad first impressions of, or things like that. Next question, CSW14 asks, are you on the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, the Fighting Spirit Magazine 50, or the 30 under 30 committees? If so, how do you approach the voting? How do you balance the breadth of wrestling versus not wading into what you don't know, assessing the documented criteria for each of these, et cetera, et cetera? I'm on two of those. I've never been invited onto the FSM 50, although, Alan, I'd love to be on the FSM 50. I know I don't really cover any new expertise ground, amongst the established people, but I would love to have a vote because I have very strong opinions on that. I know Alan respects me, so it's totally the balls in your court, Alan. For Al, I know it's kind of anonymous of who votes on these things, but I'm throwing my hat in the ring. I'd love to have a ballot. The Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame and the 30 Under 30 committees. I've been voting on, you know, the 30 Under 30. I've voted for the last 2 years. Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, I've voted on for the last like 4 or 5 years, I think. You know, the Observer Hall of Fame has really strict criteria, or at least clear criteria that's used as a model for what you should do. So I definitely think you have to check the box, either being an outstanding, you know, performer, being a big draw, or being historically relevant. I definitely think you have to check at least one of those boxes to be considered. In terms of wading into what you don't know, I don't know like Mexico that well, so I don't vote in Mexico. I don't know Rest of the World that well, so I don't vote in Rest of the World. The other is just you got to do your research. And I know you can only do so much research. I'm always going to know more about, like, you know, Randy Orton than I'm going to know about, pick someone. I'm trying to think of a historic candidate that's on the ballot that I would know very little about. Lord James Bleers or something like that. I'm always going to, just because I'm never going to be able to do enough research to make up for the fact that I've been watching Randy Orton wrestle for 20 years. That being said, I think every voter has to do due diligence and at least researching a career a little bit to see if they stand out. And that's when you find out some people really cool. Like, I'm a big supporter of Morris Siegel on that ballot. Most people don't know who Morris Siegel is, but I think you look at his track record, you look at his length as a promoter. He was a promoter for about 50 years in the Houston, Texas area. Is a huge accomplishment. That's why I like, you know, researching wrestling and being on something like the Hall of Fame committee, because it enables you to really get invested in researching these people. And I've had a great time, you know, researching Bobby Davis and being like, whoa, but, you know, I wrote an article last year on Bobby Davis for the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, which is like, essentially, I think the title is like, what are we doing? We got to get Bobby Davis in the Hall of Fame. And that's because I did my research to find out that this guy is one of the most historically important wrestling figures of all time. He essentially invented the heel manager role. A million people have subsequently copied themselves after him. Plenty of people have named themselves after Bobby Heenan. Most importantly, have named themselves after Bobby Davis, have been inspired by Bobby Davis. You know, people like Jim Cornette, people like, you know, Bobby Heenan, Paul Heyman, they all will tell you that they were inspired by the work of Bobby Davis. But anyway, I'm getting off topic here. But I think you got to do your research yourself. The Hall of Fame, though, I would say like the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, I am starting to think a little bit more about not being as big of a slave to the criteria as I used to. I think especially with some of the modern candidates where I really have the full context understanding of their careers, that I can make an informed opinion on their ability and value as a pro wrestler. I think Samoa Joe being kind of the most interesting candidate for this exercise, the one that I think really opened my eyes to someone that probably doesn't check the boxes in terms of the three listed criteria. But for me, I'm like, Samoa Joe is an excellent professional wrestler. He has been excellent for pretty much his entire career. And he's had the misfortune of having some really bumbling and incompetent booking derail his career, especially when he was working in TNA and WWE. And it's has nothing to do with him as a performer or his ability or his consistency or reliability or anything like that. I think from a talent perspective and really from an output perspective, Samoa Joe has been a Hall of Fame level wrestler, but the creative end hasn't held up his end of the bargain. In the modern era, that's huge. If the creative end isn't there for you, you're probably not going to really make it as a top star or be seen as a top star, because it's not like the territories where Samoa Joe could bounce around from territory to territory, working with different bookers, being in positions to succeed and draw, because there's all these different territories, all this different leadership that have the capacity to draw 5,000 to 10,000 fans to an arena on a Saturday night. That's not the case during most of Samoa Joe's career, where he's working in WWE, he's working in TNA, where basically if Vince Russo or Vince McMahon or Eric Bischoff or whoever's in charge doesn't really get you, you're not really going to get a chance to be a big draw. And having watched Samoa Joe's career, I understand the context of it. It is making me reconsider like voting for him, just because I would think, does he check the criteria? Really, no. You could say he's an outstanding performer, but he's really not, you know, a huge draw to the standards of what we would think of in terms of drawing power. Is he historically relevant? Really, no. But it was Samoa Joe, an absolutely excellent professional wrestler for a long time. I think absolutely he was. And that's where it's something where I think I'm kind of, as I've spent a couple, you know, voting cycles now as a voter, I'm starting to reconsider how strict I should hold up the criteria in terms of voting, or should I be using my contextual knowledge to make an argument for someone like a Samoa Joe, who you would look at, again, you would look at the criteria and be like, probably not a Hall of Famer. But then if I look at the context of his career, I'm like, you know what? Samoa Joe deserves to be in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame because he has been an outstanding pro wrestler for 20 years, even if he's never consistently got the opportunity to show it because of various reasons that were totally out of his control. I'll move on to the next question. I hope this is sounding good. I feel like I'm just kind of rambling and answering questions. I haven't really put a ton of thought into my answers to these questions. I'm kind of feel like it's better if I just let it fly. But I hope this is coming across as good audio. It might be terrible, but you know, we'll move on if it's bad audio. Avengers 23 asks, a lot of the foundation of the desire to, quote, talk ball requires historical context of professional wrestling, with so much of wrestling inaccessible because it's lost, held up in rights quandaries, or locked away in one company's archive. How do we cultivate the technical knowledge and context needed to talk ball? So talking ball. This has been a buzzword that's definitely bounced around our community. I've been using it a lot lately to describe what I feel like are not enough discussions in professional wrestling being about the actual pro wrestling product, right? Talking about matches, talking about ring work, talking about promos, talking about angles, just talking about the actual professional wrestling that we're seeing with our eyes and hearing with our ears. Instead, we're talking about the discourse or business or narratives or the media and all this stuff that isn't, you know, is important to a degree, but is removed from actual, just the real joy of professional wrestling. And talking ball would be like well-detailed, well-researched, well-understood discussion of the fabric of the industry, what we're actually seeing on television. And there's not enough of that, right? So Avenger says, you know, a lot of that requires historical context to pro wrestling. And given that it might be difficult to see some of the historical context, it might be, I don't really agree with that. I don't think much of wrestling is inaccessible because it's lost or held up in rights quandaries. I think you can get a lot of the context of professional wrestling with just simple YouTube searches, with looking up stuff. And the WWE, obviously, is everything on WWE's, you know, Peacock platform? No. But is there a lot of stuff on there? Yes. And it's all at your fingertips. It's more accessible than ever, really. I also don't think you just like to talk ball. I don't think you need to have like a massive historical understanding of pro wrestling. I just think you have to have the ability to vocalize or write down or put into words what you enjoy about pro wrestling and what you enjoyed about a match or a promo or an angle or a wrestler. I don't think you necessarily need to have like, you know, this Meltzer-like recall of all this various stuff of pro wrestling. I don't think that's necessary to what I think of when I think about talking ball. I just think what you need to have is enthusiasm and passion and an ability to at least talk about something without sounding like a complete moron. Are there people out there that only know WWE and thus every single, you know, a part of their perspective is going to be coming from the perspective of somebody who's only ever seen Vince McMahon's version of pro wrestling? Yes. But those people got to do the work. I think it's possible to do the work. I don't think it's too hard to go out and watch this different stuff. It's certainly not difficult to read, you know, all this past stuff. There's so much of this stuff is documented, but I don't think it's necessarily inaccessible. I just think people got to put in the effort. And I think the most important thing to talking ball is a willingness to kind of put some of this other, you know, nonsense aside and really talk about and focus on the product, because there's not enough of that. Especially in terms of AEW discussion, I think way too much of AEW's discussion is about the business of AEW or some narrative about the broader creative direction of AEW. that it's not focused enough on, you know, a product and what's going on in the ring. I'll take this dynamite from this past Wednesday. I wouldn't say it was like an amazing dynamite. It blew me away. But in my opinion, we saw two outstanding 4-star plus matches on Dynamite between Ricochet and Beast Mordos and the 6-man tag in the main event. I was like, that was great pro wrestling on television. And before Dynamite, we simply never got wrestling like that. And I would like to talk more about, you know, how good that was than, you know, what was the attendance for the show? Or, you know, they did this angle. What does that mean for AEW going forward? Is this going to attract fans? Blah, 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 blah. That stuff's starting to become really boring to me and starting to become not like productive to what I want to get out of as a pro wrestling fan. And it's like, I want to talk about the stuff that I liked. I want to talk about the matches that were good. I want to talk about the matches that were bad, because sometimes matches are bad. I watched that Chris Jericho versus Mystico match from the CMLL 91st Anniversario show from last weekend. That was not a good match. It's an interesting match to talk about. I think there's reasons that that match was bad, and it was largely because of an insistence on Chris Jericho's behalf of wrestling a match like he was 1992 Chris Jericho and not 2024 Chris Jericho. But that's, you know, that's a match we can talk all about. It doesn't always have to be good, but I'd rather focus on that than just focus on, you know, so much of this other outside stuff that a lot of it is just based on perception and social media feeds and just a bunch of bullshit that I'm starting to have very little patience for. Anyway, we'll move on. Tail Avery has a couple of questions here. His first question is, who is your favorite wrestler from each of the four major wrestling countries? US, Mexico, Japan, and Canada. UK definitely taking some slander here. I don't know if I really have a favorite wrestler, to be honest. There are wrestlers I think I would consider in my elite tier of wrestlers that I really love. But I don't really know if I would say I have any favorites. Like who's my favorite American wrestler of all time? I have no idea. Mick Foley is probably my favorite wrestler of all time from an American perspective. That's the first one that comes to mind. So like probably Mick Foley. Mexico, I'm not definitely a lucha historian the way that in a huge fan of lucha the way that some other people on the site are. Pedro Aguayo Sr. I find his story really interesting. I find just how massive of a star and how big of a draw he was, just having these bloody matches that were never taped because they were, you know, seen as too violent for TV. And the work that he did in the UWA in the 70s, there's the famous anecdote that they drew 1 million fans to one arena in 1 year, which, like, if you do the math, is something like they drew, you know, 28,000 fans per week for 52 weeks in a year to one arena. I can't come here and tell you like, oh, I love all these Pedro Aguayo matches, because I haven't seen a ton of them, because a lot of the stuff in his prime didn't make tape. If you're going to watch a lot of his matches, it's mostly going to be stuff from later in his career when he was in AAA. Rey Mysterio Jr. I really like. Eddie Guerrero I really like. Those are more like American wrestlers that wrestled mostly in America than Mexican wrestlers. But those would be some of the guys. Japan, there's a million good wrestlers from Japan that I like. I always would say like Toshiaki Kawada is probably my favorite wrestler of all time from Japan, but I'm obviously a huge Misawa and Kobashi fan as well. Kota Ibushi, Kazuchika Okada, Genki Horiguchi, I'm a huge fan of. There's a million guys in Japan that I love too. Jumbo Saruta, Genichiro Tenryu, Yuki Choshu. I mean, Tenryu and Saruta probably too, is just like really wrestlers that I've loved for a really long time. Canada, it's funny. It's like I can easily name Canadians more than I can name Americans. Like definitely Kenny Omega and Bret Hart, just off the top of my head, is just like two guys who I'll never get bored or tired of watching for sure. Are those two guys, but that's probably my favorite wrestlers, I would say. So let's to answer the question, I'll say Mick Foley for the United States, Pedro Aguayo for Mexico, Toshiaki Kawada for Japan, and Kenny Omega for Canada. How about that? And then he also asks, who's your favorite New England athlete from each of the four major North American sports leagues? I'll try to do this quickly. Tom Brady is my favorite Patriots player of all time. If that's too basic of an answer for you, I would say, you know, Tom Brady, Gronk, and Vince Wilfork are like my three favorite Patriots of all time. I mean, Tom is, I think, the greatest football player of all time. Gronk is, you know, probably the best tight end of all time, when just in terms of pure peak, probably not, obviously not for durability or longevity purposes, but in terms of just a complete tight end blocking and receiving. And Vince Wilfork is just a fun football player to root for. He was here for a long time. He was super professional. He's just a fun guy. You know, he's got that huge gut. He'd be out there, you know, clogging the lane, super unglamorous position, but super fun player to root for. So those would be the ones that I would root for from the Patriots. That'd be my favorite. My favorite Red Sox player of all time. You know, it's gotta be Poppy. Just because he had such a legendary, mystical aspect to him, especially just his ability to come through in the clutch. I think most fans would be familiar with his performance during the 2004 World Series and that playoff run where he just seemed to always come up big. He hit the, you know, bloop single against the Yankees to extend the series. He hit the walk-off home run against the Yankees to extend the series. I think he had a home run in game six. He's just, and that was just in one series. I mean, his 2013 World Series, where I think he had an OPS of like 1900 against the Cardinals. Like the entire Red Sox team as a team hit like 210 for the series. And Ortiz hit like 690 with like seven walks or some sort of absurd number. His on-base percentage was like 800 or something like that for the series. Totally carried the team, put it on his back. And just like a huge personality, just a huge star around Boston, the most beloved Red Sox player of all time. It's either him or Yaz, and no one else is really close, I think. Like Ted Williams is the best player of all time, but Ted Williams was not beloved, certainly not in his time, the way David Ortiz was, the way Carl Yastrzemski was. You know, and he went out still playing at a high level. One of my favorite David Ortiz stats is that he led the league in doubles his last year as a Major League Baseball player. And that's pretty impressive enough. But when you actually watched him day to day, the man had no legs. He couldn't run. If he wasn't a DH, if it wasn't for the DH rule, he definitely wouldn't have been able to play baseball. But he could still stand in that box and he could still drive the ball and spray it to all fields. And he led the league in doubles. And there wasn't a single one of those doubles that season where he like legged it out and like stretched a single into a double. Every single one of those hits had to be like a surefire double and would have been a triple for like most players. But that's how good he was, and that's how much he just owned the zone as a hitter. And he was a joy to watch for his entire time he was here. Other random Red Sox player, I mean, Mookie Betts, the trade still sings. Probably just the overall best Red Sox player of my lifetime would be Mookie Betts, just as a complete player. I'm a little too young to remember Pedro at his peak. I would have been like 5 or 6 in, you know, 1999, 2000, when Pedro was absolutely dominant. So I can't really say Pedro, even though I obviously understand that he is an iconic pitcher and one of the greatest pitchers of all time. Some random players that I really liked. I liked Kevin Millar as a kid. I don't really know why. I just liked his game. He hit a bunch of home runs in the 2003, 2004 season. Tim Wakefield, late Tim Wakefield, is a knuckleballer, is obviously a fan favorite, was pitched here forever. So those would be some of my Red Sox guys. The Bruins, I don't really watch hockey, so I don't really have a strong take on the Bruins. I would say Zdeno Chara, just because obviously he was a great player. He's been a great figure in the city of Boston. He's been a super fun guy to learn about. He's like a polyglot. He's got all these different skills. He sells real estate. He speaks like 10 languages. He runs the Boston Marathon every year. I've seen him running the marathon because he stands out because he's like a full head taller than anyone else in the pack. It's pretty funny. So I'd probably say him. I don't really know. Like, I know the hockey players. I know Joe Thornton and Tuukka Rask and Patrice Bergeron and like the big players who have played for the Bruins. But I can't say I've been like watching all of their games and can remember them playing. So I don't really have a strong take on them. And for the Celtics, it's got to be Paul Pierce. You know, I didn't see Bill Russell, Bob Cousy, John Havlicek, Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, like all these other great Celtics players. I've read a lot about them. I've watched tape of them. I love them all, but I can't really say they're my favorite because I never really watched them live. You know, Paul Pierce is the guy. I think that 2008 title team was so satisfying just because, really because of Pierce, because he had been playing on a losing team for a number of years. He was our all-star, but he really hadn't won anything as a player. And just seeing the complete turnaround from, you know, the 2006-2007 season to the 2007-2008 season, and seeing his performance shine during that time period with the new big three era with Garnett and Allen, just another, you know, all-time legendary, you know, clutch performer for this franchise, made a ton of big shots. Even when the team wasn't very good, he was still a good go-to guy down the stretch. So, you know, Tatum and Brown are definitely catching up. You know, we'll see. I mean, it's hard to deny that they have to be amongst your favorites. Al Horford too, as guys that have helped, you know, put Banner, you know, 18 in the rafters. So we'll see on that. That one definitely is going to change. Like, I don't think there's any Patriot player in danger of knocking off Tom Brady. I don't think there's any Red Sox player of knocking off David Ortiz, but but Tatum and Brown definitely are going to be close to knocking off Pierce pretty soon. Anyway, that was a long question. Another sports question. Wow. Refused Party Program says, favorite football, parentheses, soccer player of all time. Not best, not most successful, just more, I fucking love that guy. To make it more interesting, he can't ever have played for your team. Okay, so my favorite player of all time is Harry Kane. Similar to like liking Paul Pierce or liking Tom Brady. You know, I'm a Tottenham fan. Harry Kane's my guy. I watched his entire career here. He's my favorite player of all time. The other guy I would say is Zlatan Ibrahimovic. But I will say Zlatan Ibrahimovic actually really played for my team. Not a team I supported directly at the club level, but to tell you my experience with Zlatan, which I can't believe anyone cares about this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Growing up, I played soccer. I played soccer on like a really diverse soccer team. It was, you know, a lot of Latin players from different countries. And those guys were so proud of their heritage and being immigrants or children of immigrants from these different countries. And they were Mexicans, Brazilians, Colombians, Guatemalans, and their national identity, you know, their ethnic history was so important to them. And, you know, as a generic white guy, it wasn't that important to me. But being around all those guys so much made me want to kind of, you know, act the part, act like, you know, I was, you know, really proud of my heritage, which I was, but not in the same way. It's just different. And I'm really not that much Swedish, but I'm a little bit Swedish. And, you know, I'm mostly Irish, but being Irish is kind of generic. Everyone's Irish. So I was like, you know what? I want to like play up the Swedish thing. I'm going to get like a Swedish shirt. I'm going to get a national team jersey. I'm going to, you know, really be like lean into this because it'll help me connect with my teammates, because, you know, they'll talk about their national team, I'll talk about my national team, you know, we can both talk about the U.S. national team. But it was kind of like this way to relate to my teammates. And so like I got really into Sweden and the Swedish national team, and as luck would have it, Sweden happened to produce not only an incredibly gifted, talented, internationally recognized player, but a super fun flair player that any, you know, country of any fan around the world would be able to recognize an outstanding, fun player in Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And, you know, it was really cool because I think like anyone that's, especially, this is especially true in the United States, where if you like soccer, like I do, and you go and play soccer with different people, you play with a lot of people from different ethnic backgrounds because soccer is the world's game. And there's so many people, whether they're from Uganda, whether they're from Brazil, whether they're from Guatemala, whether they're from Germany or Spain or Japan or China, like I've played, you know, pick up soccer with all these different types of people. And there's just, especially in the Latin game, there's something different about their passion that like, it's kind of, you don't want to be like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like, you don't want to be like the white guy that's like going up to the guy in the Botafogo jersey and being like, oh, hey, like, yeah, I like the English Premier League. I love soccer. Like it just, it comes across as like almost like a poser, because some of these different cultures, especially in the Latin American cultures, they live it so much. It's such a big part of their culture and their identity. But like the American guy that started watching soccer 5 or 6 years ago on Saturday mornings just can't really relate to them. It just feels like you're kind of like trying too hard. But having a guy like Zlatan, who was so internationally recognized that everyone respected as an incredible player, I think really helped me as a young player, have confidence playing with different people and getting to talk and understand people that were different than me. And so that's why Zlatan is probably my, favorite all-time player. But since I was such a supporter of the Sweden national team, he did kind of play for my team. So I'm just going to rattle off a bunch of guys that I really liked playing, watch play. Thierry Henry being one of them. He's obviously a player on Tottenham's rival Arsenal's team, but obviously there's no denying that Henry was an incredible player. I'm a huge fan of Thomas Müller. I think he's super underrated. I think as like a number 10, I think, we focus so much on number, when we talk about attacking midfielders, we focus so much on skills and technical quality and the ability to dribble, the ability to create, the ability to perform the spectacular, like, right? Who's the quintessential number 10? It's someone like Diego Maradona, right? Just an insanely talented, fast, gifted player. Thomas Müller's kind of the opposite of that. He's extremely efficient. He's super German in terms of that stereotype. But you look at his production at attacking midfield, his goals and assists, he has the numbers of like a striker, but he played attacking midfield. He's won absolutely everything at every level. He's still playing at a pretty high level for Bayern Munich. I always thought he's super underrated. I've always been a fan of his. Ronaldo Clásico. I don't really care about Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi. They're obviously two amazing players. Messi's probably the greatest player of all time. Ronaldo's not too far behind in the all-time rankings. But like, I don't, those guys, they're almost like the conversations around them are so toxic and so basic in a lot of ways that I've never really felt super invested in either of them. So I don't really care about either of them. Brazilian Ronaldo, Ronaldo number 9, Ronaldo O Fenomeno, whatever you want to call him. Absolutely incredible player. I think my favorite quote about him was that he is not a man, he is a herd. Just because seeing him rampaging on the ball, his speed, his power, his strength, his clinical finishing, I don't think there's ever been a player like him. I don't know if there'll ever be a player again. I guess Haaland is kind of the closest to him, but Ronaldo had like the Brazilian flair that I don't think Haaland has, and was a more complete player than Haaland. But similar kind of just the physical ability combined with clinical striking. Ronaldo's a classic. There's so many great soccer players out there that I've enjoyed watching. N'Golo Kante, obviously incredible story, just an incredible type of player. It's kind of similar to Charlie Joseph when I was talking about Charlie Joseph. I mean, N'Golo Kante is obviously a lot better, but very similar type of player in terms of just like a ball-winning midfielder with tremendous energy. I really like soccer history. So there's a bunch of guys that I can say, like, I never really watched play, but I'm really fascinated by their careers and have liked learning about them and learning about their stories and things like that. Players from the past that are great, like Eusebio, like Alfredo Di Stefano, Frank Puskas, Jose Manuel Morena. Just like a lot of really fascinating, interesting guys that have had different careers. Joseph Bakan, Lev Yashin, there's so much to, I love history and kind of getting into soccer, I think a little bit later in terms of like my other, as opposed to like my other fandoms, like wrestling or basketball or football or things like that. I just am really intrigued by how much there is to learn and still to learn about and read about and watch YouTube videos and everything like that. So that was a really long-winded question and answer. But yes, I fucking love all those guys. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about soccer, refused party program. Gerard D. Trollio asks, and this is the last question, actually. Wow, I got through these, just blown right through them. And so Gerard's question is, do you think American weekly TV format, pioneered by Raw and Nitro, hinders AEW's ability to differentiate itself from WWE? So this is kind of the question I was talking about. Kazanidir asked about this earlier, kind of talking about, could another kind of presentation of pro wrestling really take off? And Gerard is using, the example of really that television wrestling, no matter who you're talking about, whether it's Raw or SmackDown or even, TNA or, of course, Dynamite Collision, they're all using the same format that was really kind of introduced by Eric Bischoff and WCW in the mid-90s when Nitro was created. And AEW's, from a formatting perspective, really doesn't differentiate that much from those. And is that ultimately a big curse in the product not being able to stand out different from WWE? And I think that's it's definitely true to a degree. I guess my take on this is that I don't think that there's Well, I have two takes on it. The first is I don't really think that there's anything wrong with the formats. I don't think that ultimately sets up different, allows you to be different than those other companies. I think the contents, I think the types of wrestlers that you're pushing, the types of angles that you're presenting, where you're trying to derive drama from, all of that is far, far, far more important in terms of differentiating the product than the TV format. I think the TV format is fine. I think when we watch a Dynamite and it really hits and it's clicking on all cylinders, I don't think anyone is concerned about the TV format. I think the average fan, the typical fan, and even the hardcore fan likes the TV format. We like seeing matches. We like seeing in-ring promos. We like seeing backstage promos. We like seeing video packages. When all that stuff is well done, all of that stuff kicks ass. It's when that stuff is bad that we start asking ourselves, like, why do we have to see this? Why is this, you know, why is Dynamite starting with a long promo? No one asks that if the promo was really good. It only comes up when the promo was bad. So I think that it's much more of a content thing than anything. I don't think the format is really an issue. But the second take I have on it is it's hard for me to envision a different TV format than this kind of TV format where you have promos, you have matches, you do some backstage stuff, you have the TV announcers. Like, this is, that has been what we have seen on American weekly television wrestling for the last 30 years. Now you can go back and look at older wrestling. You can look at like WCW Saturday Night in the early 90s, or you can go back even further in some of the territories and kind of the different ideas that they had. But that was so long ago, and the technology is so much more advanced, and the fans have been conditioned in such a different way that I just don't know if you can like really learn that much from those formats and implement them in a modern space. I definitely think something a little bit different, like Lucha Underground, it's definitely different. Would Lucha Underground have been a little bit more successful if it had a more traditional TV model and wasn't necessarily focused on, you know, soap opera drama and eventually leading to magic and stuff like that? I think that's a real question to be asked. It was different for sure, and people like pointing out that it was different, but was it ultimately successful? Would it ultimately have been more successful if it tried to be a little bit more conservative in that approach? I'm not sure. But as far as AEW's ability to differentiate itself from WWE, I think that totally comes down to content and decision-making, like who you're going to push, what kind of stars are you going to put in the main event angle, who you're going to trust to be your world champion, all that stuff. AEW can make itself very, very different than WWE, and I think has to a lot of degree. I definitely think when you see some of this, like, you know, MJF doing kind of this comedy and kind of the presentation of the product being a little bit more sports entertainment-y, that's definitely something that the company should probably try to get away from. But I don't know if that's something that really has to be adjusted through the TV format as much as it is content control. But that is pretty much my take on that. And that is pretty much my take on all of these questions. Like I said, I really appreciate them. I hope they made sense. I was kind of wavering midway through. I was like, is this actually going to be good audio? Because I feel like I'm just kind of rambling and talking really fast. But hopefully people enjoyed it. And if they didn't, we'll have a more traditional episode coming up next time. But I appreciate all the continued support and listenership. I guess, like, if I could ask a request, if you wanted to leave a review in like the Apple Store or on Spotify, I'm told that would help more people see my product, which I'm always interested in, even if I'm not necessarily obsessed with that. But if people want to do that, if you haven't already, that would be great. But only if you have a good review. Like, I don't want honest reviews on there, to be honest. I don't want like a 3-star review talking about my strengths and weaknesses. I'll be totally transparent. I just want you to say the show is awesome, or just slap that 5 stars, no comment. That's fine too. Please do not be actually honest. Just 5 stars, please. If you're going to be honest, please do not leave anything. Like, just got to be transparent like that. But thanks a lot, and I'll talk to everyone again after a while. Bye-bye. Hey, everybody. My name is Jesse Collings, and I want to tell you all about my show, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we do a thorough analysis on the biggest issues and trends within the pro wrestling industry. We talk a lot about pro wrestling media. We talk a lot about fan culture and wrestling's place within general pop culture, and we talk about the broader influences that are shaping the way we discuss and analyze the pro wrestling industry. We've had some of the brightest minds in the pro wrestling intelligentsia on the show, including WrestleNomics host Brandon Thurston, both Rich Kreich and Joe Lanza from the Flagship Wrestling Podcast, Trevor Dame from the Through the Years podcast, and a whole lot more. This isn't a show for hot takes. It's not a show recapping the latest episode of television. This is a show focusing on the biggest topics in pro wrestling and doing a deep dive on the real stories behind the surface level analysis you might find elsewhere. The Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a try. Thanks.